You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Friday, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters Friday. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
Hey, this is James Altucher.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. How are you?
I am good, thank you.
Now, Jane, I'm sorry to call you Jane. Do people call you Governor?
Some people call me Governor, and I tell them all to call me Jane.
Okay, good. Because I have to, can I make a confession to you?
Sure.
So,
you know I'm not a priest or anything, right?
I know you're not a priest, yes.
Okay.
You were the governor of Massachusetts from 2001 to 2003. And
yep.
Here's the issue. You are like the only governor in the history of the world who is not on Wikipedia or anywhere else.
I am too on Wikipedia.
I could not find you. You're like really hard to find. And I would think...
Oh, Google Jane Swift, governor.
Oh, wait. You know what? Maybe I even had your last...
The first hit is Wikipedia.
You know what?
And a bunch of unattractive pictures.
You know what? I bet you I had your last name wrong. I had Jane Smith.
See? That would
right.
Make it really hard to find me. But I'm glad we cleared that up before we started the interview.
No, I'm recording. So I'm just totally making a fool of myself in front of my audience. Okay. But I have learned about you. And your birthday is the same day as my daughter's birthday. So I'm also very happy to interview you.
That's great, Pisces.
Yes, we have a lot in common now. But I have to say, you're like also an amazing person. Like, you've done so many different things. But A, you were a governor. You were pregnant while governor and had twins while governor. Am I correct?
Yeah.
And now, since then, you've done all of these from nonprofit to for-profit educational ventures. And I want to talk a lot about that because I'm really interested in the state of education in the U.S. But if it's okay with you, I want to kind of first talk about being governor, because that sounds cool to me.
Sure.
So, how did you, first off, back in 2001, what happened? Like, how were you? You were a lieutenant governor, and then what happened?
So I was fortunate enough to serve as lieutenant governor with Paul Fulci, who unfortunately has since passed away. But Governor Fulci and I had a professional relationship predating our running on the same ticket. In fact, I had served in the state Senate where he had been a member. I helped the administration that he was a part of to pass some laws, and we had just developed a deep respect for each other. And he invited me to run with him in the first election where he ran for a full term, and that was in 1998. And in fact, consistent with the storyline, I was pregnant then too. And so my first daughter was born 6 weeks before my first election to, well, not even 6 weeks, I guess. I guess it had to be like 3 weeks before my election to lieutenant governor. And we served very collaboratively. He delegated a lot of important responsibility to me, including around education. And then in 2000, he had been a longtime supporter of the Bush family and their political endeavors. and was a strong supporter of then Governor Bush's candidacy for president. And so he told me at a very funny lunch meeting that I thought I had asked him to schedule with me, and he thought he had asked me to schedule. And we sat down to lunch. We made small talk and at private lunch, and I was getting ready to share with him my very big news. And before I could get to it, he wanted to share with me, I think it was about a week before the 2000 election, that he believed that Governor Bush would win the election, and if he did, there was a strong probability that he would receive an appointment to that administration, and therefore I should start thinking through what it would be like to be the first woman to serve as governor in Massachusetts. And also that if he lost.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but also I should mention you were the youngest, I guess, female governor in U.S. history.
Yeah, I guess so, but that is probably a factor of there not being very many governors who are women.
Yes.
Or not enough. So, but I was relatively young. I was 36.
A baby yourself.
35 maybe at that point. I don't remember. I think I might have been 35 at that point. Yeah. You know, then I hated it when people called me young. Now I crave attention to people telling me I'm young. But that's a distraction from the story. So anyway, he told me all this wonderful news, told me that, you know, if there was not a win for Bush and if John Kerry got appointed by Al Gore, if Al Gore won, that he would also consider appointing me to the U.S. Senate. And to that point, Massachusetts didn't yet have a U.S. senator. And then I had to tell him that I also had wanted to have lunch because I was pregnant with twins. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion today that continues, and I have three daughters, so I'm glad for the progress, but a lot of discussion that continues today about the challenges and opportunities for working mothers in our country, both from a policy standpoint, but also in having leaders who are willing to give enormous responsibility to working mothers, and that's not something you consistently find. And to his credit, Governor Scilucci at the time, he may have actually done a little bit of a double take, but just as he had responded.
You mean he threw up all over the table?
He did not throw up. He actually was extremely supportive, just as he was supported when I was pregnant during our entire campaign for office
good.
In 1998. And I think not unrelated to the fact that he has two daughters and a very strong and successful wife. But I was just very, very fortunate throughout my political career to have men who saw my passion for politics and, more importantly, for public policy, especially around education, and who believed in me and supported and encouraged me to jump into the fray. It was, in fact, a state senator that I was working for in 1990 who tapped me on the shoulder and suggested that he was not going to run for office and that I should run in his place.
Let me ask you that. Was the process of running like what you expected? Because it strikes me that once you enter the political machine, people have all sorts of like values and things they believe in and things and messages that they're feel strongly about. But then when they're in the machine, it becomes
yes.
about fundraising and saying what other people want you to say. And it becomes very difficult. Although maybe for state Senate, it's a small enough constituency that you can override that.
Yeah. So I continue to teach a class at Williams College about political leadership and have current political leaders and others involved in the political process come in. So I know a lot has changed in 10 years, but I have to say that first and foremost, I didn't feel turned off by the political process. In fact, my time running for office and serving in office was some of the most rewarding, engaging, fulfilling work that I've ever done. And I also worked with by far some of the smartest, most passionate people you will ever meet. And so I bristle a bit at the sort of generally held notions that, you know, politics is a terrible business and everything is corrupt or perverse, because that wasn't my experience. Having said that, you're correct. I was running for the first time for a state Senate seat, but, you know, I raised $60,000, which at the time was a lot of money for a state Senate seat in Western Massachusetts. But I raised it by working really hard to convince people that I would be the best state senator in the district. And some people, when I convinced them of that, could write me a $500 check or a $1,000 check, which was the limit at the time. Other people baked brownies every single Friday, and we would have these killer bake sales in front of my office that only a candidate who comes from a large, close-knit Catholic family could pull off. And literally would have people who went to school with my parents or whose children went to school with one of my siblings who would show up every week and donate cookies or whoopie pies, and we would sell those, and we calculated that we made enough money every week on our bake sale to pay the rent and utilities for our entire office. Now, I know that's not a presidential campaign today,
right?
But the concepts are the same. You have to convince people that you will be the best candidate. I think the big money that goes into politics around very specific issues that certain people make decisions around isn't good, but fundraising in and of itself, I think, is a really important aspect of running for political office, because I had to be really crisp and really convincing and really think through my position on all number of issues to convince people that a 25-year-old woman, a couple of years out of college, would be a better state senator than a 7-term incumbent lawyer state representative.
And what inspired you as a 25-year-old to make that leap instead of going on to some other career venture?
So, first of all, my father had been a volunteer in political campaigns, and I knew politicians that I could look up to. The state senator who I went to work for a year was someone that my family and I supported. His predecessor was a wonderful, wonderful man, and my dad had served as his campaign manager. It was really around a passionate belief that a lot of 25-year-olds have that I could make things better. And I loved teaching at Williams because I think there are hundreds and thousands and probably hundreds of thousands of college students and young adults just like me who believe the same thing. For me, I had grown up in a blue-collar industrial city that, it turns out, had a pretty poor public education system. I didn't realize that until I went to a very competitive, elite, small college in Hartford, Connecticut called Trinity, and was astonished that I was not the biggest rock star on campus academically. My social skills actually held up pretty well, but academically, I had not been as well prepared as other students. And I believed then and continue to believe now that the key to the American experience, to the American dream, is giving everybody a high-quality education that will allow them to be successful. I also grew up in a small business family, and at the time I ran, the Massachusetts economy and fiscal situation was in pretty desperate shape. And so focusing on those issues, small business competitiveness and fiscal discipline, were pretty key. And those continue to be my core beliefs to this day. And I'm lucky to be able to continue to make a difference from a different seat on issues of educational excellence and access to opportunity.
So when you first got into the governorship, it's you didn't have time to kind of like relax and say, wow, I'm governor. Like, you kind of went right into there, and there was a shitstorm, which is essentially, you know, not only the economy at the time, but 9/11 happened. The planes lifted off from airports in Massachusetts, and you were literally kind of on the equivalent of ground zero for Massachusetts as to how to deal with security, terrorism, everything. Like, what was going on? I want to ask you how you felt and everything when you became governor, but what was going on 9/11? Because you were there.
So I don't think your program is long enough, although I appreciate this extended format to go into completely how I was feeling and what it was like on 9/11. But I will tell you, one of the leadership lessons that I took from that is how critically important it is when you're making big decisions to have the right people around the table. And that, well, sometimes, depending on the issue, the right people around the table are folks who you know well and trust a great deal. At 9/11, I was fortunate enough to have a cadre of people assembled who had deep subject matter expertise on an area where, frankly, I had very little. And so we had sort of two issues to deal with. One was electoral law. We were in the midst of a primary election, and there was a lot of disagreement among other constitutional officers as to whether or not we should suspend the primary election to fill an open congressional seat. I exercised the bully pulpit. It's not clear I had the constitutional authority, but I made the decision and announced it that we would not close the polls and that we would stand up to terrorists. And that was based on really good advice from the Democrat Attorney General, who counseled me well on that issue. And then, obviously, the safety and security issues. And whether it was the superintendent of the state police or the head of the firefighters union or the head of our emergency management, our public safety individuals, they were a lot of folks who I hadn't previously worked in any depth with, and I certainly had very little experience or knowledge around domestic terror attacks.
I think your leadership lesson is extremely important, because this holds true whether you're an entrepreneur or an artist of some form, or you're building your relationships in life. The people you have around you are really the key to success, because that's gonna fill up all of your weaknesses and bring you up in many cases.
Absolutely, and I've been reading up a lot about teams, and you know, I try a lot to when I'm not just scrambling to build a business that's scaling, to figure out how to transfer the skills from politics and political leadership that I even teach about into the entrepreneurial forum.
So. I also want to reel back, like, you became governor, and by the way, as great as it is that Paul Cellucci, you know, got an appointment with the Bush administration, is it really better to be ambassador to Canada than governor of Massachusetts?
Well, he had been governor of Massachusetts. He had served as lieutenant governor for a good period of time, and I think he would say it was a wonderful appointment that brought him a lot of opportunity and joy. I was pretty happy being the governor of Massachusetts, and if I ever took an ambassadorship, I think I'd aim for a warmer country.
Well, okay, so the day you become governor, I think at the time you were also the youngest governor in the country, male or female. I might be mistaken, but...
Again, please keep mentioning how young I was, because yes, Now I crave that attention.
It's amazing how young you were when you were one of the most powerful people in the country. But
I'm going to make my mother listen to this.
And this is just a naive, like, fanboy question, but what was it like to be, like, kind of the ruler of one of the first states of the country for, you know, that day? You were like king. Or queen.
So luckily, again, I have this big Catholic family that keeps me pretty well grounded. The day we were doing the transfer ceremony, I was obscenely pregnant with twins, and the last person to speak to me before I descended this big marble staircase on live television was my older brother, who said, "There's no way you can walk down those stairs without falling."
Oh my gosh, were you scared?
Yeah, he doesn't remember it. I will never forget it. So siblings and now children, teenage girls, keep you pretty humble. But, you know, I have always felt that I've been very, very lucky in my life and blessed with a bunch of opportunities. I tend to outwork people. I will never be the smartest person in the room. I probably will never be the thinnest person in the room unless I find a really well-suited room. But I often hope that I work harder. And as a working mother, I've learned a little bit to work hard and smart. So I didn't spend a lot of time sort of reflecting. I spent a lot of time working to try to make a difference because I knew I had a short period of time guaranteed to me and a lot of things I wanted to accomplish. And I also had a toddler and twin, infant twins for most of the time. So it was hard to find a lot of time for reflection on how cool was I.
Right. And so obviously at some point I want to ask about, you know, that process of having twins and how you managed to kind of balance, you know, when people talk about work-life balance, they're sort of like they're talking about they work at the factory and then they have kids and they have to have work-life balance. And you were governor and had to have work-life balance. But what incidents were not incidents, but what issues do you think you really feel you accomplished and you're proud of during your time as governor? You were governor from 2001 to 2003. Then yeah. Mitt Romney came along. But where do you feel you had impact?
So three areas. So I was lucky enough that we were at the critical time of implementing some of the education reforms that I had helped to create in 1993 when I was a state senator. And so it was when I was governor, was the first year that Massachusetts students had to pass a comprehensive assessment test in order to receive their diploma. That was very controversial, but it was the right decision at the time.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. I tend to be an interrupter, but I want to play a devil's advocate on that just for a second.
Yep.
I understand the need for an assessment test because you want to make sure people have a certain level of it's hard to judge a large number of people without some standardization, but does standardization ultimately hurt the youth of America? When you try to have one comprehensive
standardization,
test.
I'm an interrupter too, sorry. So okay, I totally believe that standardization does hurt. And frankly, I will tell you that my position on testing then and now is different because our assessment system was developed over, I told you we developed the law in 1993, and it was 2002 before we held students accountable. We involved educators in a very comprehensive process of figuring out what do students need to know. And then we designed our own assessment system, not a standardized test, that was very closely aligned to the curriculum that we had implemented across the state through comprehensive input with educators. I think that is very, very different than a standardized test that is much more reflective of how many words your parents used when you were a baby or how much affluence you have. And so I actually would be happy to spend the rest of the show talking about testing and assessment because I think we somewhat lost our way as a country, but there is a rub, right? So I told you my motivation was I graduated from high school. I was in the top 10% of my class. I was pretty much all world in North Adams, Massachusetts. And I show up at Trinity College, which is a great school, but it's not Harvard, and realized I was probably in the bottom 20%. We have to solve for that problem. There has to be a systemic way to ensure that kids, no matter how rich or poor or in the right zip code their parents are, get access to the same level of education. An assessment is one way you can do that, measuring all students against the same expectation of what they'll need to know. My husband and I were having a conversation this morning about, you know, an individual that's where you come into contact with who's a single mother and very poor, and you're just talking about those people in our own life who never got the educational opportunity that we're, you know, working and bending over backwards to get to our kids, and that I try really hard in my professional life to extend to as many students in the United States as possible, the really tragic consequences and difficult lives that people lead when they don't get it. Well, having said that, there's no doubt in my mind the over-testing that's happening in some school districts that is in part engendered by poor leadership and deeply aided and abetted by a zealous commitment to testing in our public policy, also doesn't result in the kind of great, engaging, personalized education that I want for my own kids. So I think you've struck on one of the most critical public policy issues. And unfortunately, like most tough public policy issues, I don't think there's a simple answer. I don't think it's more tests and I don't think it's less tests. I think it's better education aligned to high quality assessment.
Yeah, and I you make a really good point that, of course, people in kids in underprivileged situations just simply need access to education, and that's a huge win.
They don't need access to education. They need access to the same type of high-quality, engaging education that you and I want for our children.
Right.
And that's a much harder thing to create.
And at the same time, I wonder, like, let's say a young child is meant to be the greatest artist or musician or a ballerina or venture capitalist or whatever in the world, but the way things are taught in school, there's just no way they can fit in, and so they're not going to do well on any assessment or standardized test or whatever. How do you deal with kids who are just different but special?
Yeah, so life would have it. I have three children, and one of them learns very differently. And so I believe first and foremost, all children can learn. And there are certain basic things even great artists and great venture capitalists and great ballerinas need to know in a very competitive global economy.
Like what?
However, like what?
Yeah.
Basic math and computation principles, how to analyze complex texts and understand their meaning, how to be a good citizen, and go beyond Trumpisms and evaluate the quality of ideas of our leaders. All of those, I think, are critically important. But there's lots of different ways that you can gain those skills. And a standardization of instruction, I think, is what you're really getting at, is deeply problematic and in some cases an outgrowth of testing. And I think there are a couple ways, frankly, to address that. First and foremost, we need more choice, parental choice, supported by our government in schools. There are great innovative schools that people with means find to send their children to. And that is increasingly, with charter schools and choice in some communities, available to all parents, but by no means is it available enough to students across the country. And so providing an opportunity for parents to find that right learning environment for their child that does have high standards, but also can truly personalize learning, I think is critical. My oldest daughter is a really strong natural math and science student, but reading was just painful to her. And we went through all the testing and everything. She could read. She just didn't enjoy it. She hated doing analysis until we found a couple really special teachers. And last year, as a sophomore in high school, she had a young teacher who made it acceptable for every student to either read the book or listen to an audio presentation of the book.
Wow,
and
that's great.
She won the English prize for her class.
Wow.
I did not get a picture because I knew that they were giving out prizes and I knew she was going to get one, but I was not ready with my camera when they started talking about English. I mean, that's just a little snippet of a story, but But all kids can learn. Yes, you have to reach them in different ways. And all children have gifts that we have to access. But it's having an enriching and wonderful and deep education, I don't think, is at odds with also making sure there are some critical academic skills that every child has to possess by the time they leave high school.
And I agree with you. I might err on the little side of homeschooling or unschooling, but that's a choice that's not available to everyone. It's the same kind of mess of issues.
Yeah,
but,
and so one of the things that Middlebury Interactive Languages, our terrific world language programs, are broadly adopted by homeschool audiences. So depending what your ability is to teach Spanish or French or German or Mandarin, you should become one of our customers.
Yeah, maybe I will, because my wife is from Argentina, and she's been begging me for 6 years to learn Spanish, and I've been thinking of using Duolingo to learn.
Duolingo is a great program for consumers. Our program is actually more geared towards your kids, but it sounds like your wife might be able to teach them Spanish.
Oh, I am a child when it comes to learning languages, so I'll cry if I don't know a word. But you know, your daughter had an amazing experience where the teacher said, okay, you can use an audiobook, and that, of course, is not standardized or accepted.
Although,
across.
I will tell you, we are seeing, so this is from a not just a parental standpoint, and I do have three kids in high school now, but also from a business standpoint, the speed of adoption of technologies that facilitate better learning and personalization in the classroom is finally starting to happen at scale in the United States. Well, and certainly our company is a beneficiary of that. And I will, you know, continue to preach, not just on behalf of our company and the fact that we bring world languages into schools that otherwise would have a very limited curriculum for students and languages, but there are all kinds of, I mean, audiobooks is just a really basic one. There are all kinds of great technologies that schools are starting to adapt that really will help us to get to that deeply enriching educational experience at scale for all students.
Now, do you think there's any kind of, I don't want to sound like conspiracy theorist, but I look at my kids, I have two daughters in high school, and I look at my kids' textbooks, and they have to carry them around in these big backpacks, and they're like 8,000 pages each. And I showed my daughter, look, on Amazon, you can not only buy your textbook on Kindle, so you don't have to carry it around, but you can buy the teacher's edition and get all the answers to all the homework. So
my kids are in a Catholic school in Vermont, so this is not like the cutting, bleeding edge of technology or progressivism. And they just went to a one-to-one device, bring your own device in their school. Almost all of their textbooks now are available digitally online in the student version. And you're right. It sounds like a stupid thing, but I mean, we couldn't find a backpack big enough for my girls to carry when they had to carry all of their books. But they now are taking, notes and Google Classroom, they're sharing their documents, they are submitting papers through Turnitin to make sure that they're not plagiarizing. If it's happening in a Catholic high school in Vermont, there's hope. And we see it from a business standpoint that with the huge turnover of teachers, which is causing other challenges to quality education, you're having an increasingly young teacher workforce who are able to integrate appropriately technology into the classroom to improve the experience for students.
So you're telling me more about kind of the impact you had as governor.
Oh, right. So I got as far as education. And
yeah, you got to number
and then
one.
Two other issues. We talked a little bit. I do think calming the state and reforming our airport system and contributing in the national debate to the development of Homeland Security.
Okay, can I ask you about that?
Sure.
So there's been a lot of argument, and for instance, in the book Freakonomics, they did a whole study, or maybe it was Super Freakonomics, they did a whole study that the increases in airport security led to more people driving to long distances, led to more traffic deaths than would have otherwise happened in plane accidents, because planes hardly ever have any deaths other than in a terrorist attack. So do you think as a state or as a country, we made a mistake going overboard on airport security?
So I don't think we made a mistake. I now travel by air in the last couple of weeks, almost every week. So, you know, be careful what you wish for. I subjected myself to a just not very fun experience going through security. And I probably am one of those people who, you know, when it's a close call, I drive. I think the thing that those statistics don't take into account is the psychological trauma of another air attack on U.S. soil and what that would do to our economy. That's hard to quantify.
Right, but that psychological trauma, isn't that, and I hate to use the Bill Maher phrase, but isn't that like we let the terrorists win?
It absolutely is, and I think our political leaders have to be, I mean, there's a huge impact on the economy. If we measure consumer confidence, you would have no consumer confidence. And while it may or may not be fair to say that every, you know, president since Bush has to be responsible for making sure there's not another 9/11 style airline attack, I think that's just the reality. Just be deeply troubling to the U.S. So I think the airport security stuff is, I think it does catch some stuff. I don't think it's perfect, but I do think it was necessary.
In the privileged position you were in, were you aware of anything else happening either that day or in the months or years afterwards that did test the system that the nation doesn't really know about?
Well, I think the nation knows about it, but maybe not as quickly or to the degree I did. So the shoe bomber tried to blow up an airline. Now he came from another country, but he ended up landing at Logan, and they knew within moments that he had ties to terrorists. And I think it was downplayed, frankly, more than the reality. There were a handful of other things that I think were thwarted. I'm sure there have been many more that are not reported. I think that's a real challenge, frankly, of Homeland Security. The whole goal is to not make people feel so unsafe as to disrupt our economy. And so you really can't tout your wins would undo the public policy.
What's the worst thing you heard about that maybe other people have heard about that was thwarted that wasn't really widely known?
You know what? I don't think it's more just the, so I don't know if it would have happened, but there was a lot of concern about attacks through the harbors and potential chemical weapons attacks in New York or the Boston area, which I think were very widely reported in the months, I guess, after 9/11. You know, when you get a call from the U.S. Attorney General, telling you there's a lot of chatter and they can't give you more specifics, that's not a great way to spend the rest of your weekend.
So here you are, you had just had twins, and the Attorney General of the United States is calling you, the governor of Massachusetts, and saying,
and luckily, I wasn't the leak. I think it was actually another elected official who let that word out.
But the buck stops with you when it comes to like what's going on in Massachusetts. And were you scared?
I was worried. I wasn't scared. I realized that I actually had the most powerful thing, which was information, which brings with it an obligation, but also power, right? And again, we had, you know, Massachusetts is a phenomenal state with deep resources, financial, intellectual. I had access to people to help me put in place protections and plans and responses that I was fortunate to have. So, you know, we had a former head of the, you know, U.S. Air Force who helped us think through security at Logan Airport. We had, you know, the former CEO who had served in Vietnam but was the CEO of one of the large financial institutions in Boston, leading a task force about how to improve security. So I wasn't scared. I was often worried. And I realized that I had been given a privilege to take care of and protect people that was not really a burden, but quite a big responsibility at the time.
And now nobody would ever say this to a man, but did people say this to you? Like, oh, she just had twins. We're going through the worst national disaster in U.S. history. Maybe this is not for her because she's.
Ironically, that was the one time when people didn't say that.
That's great.
And I remember going into my first press conference on the mid-morning, early afternoon of 9/11, and it was the least confident I ever felt on the inside. And if you read press reports, it was some of the most, probably the most highly regarded press conference from the press's perspective that I ever gave. So I prayed a lot that day. I realized that I had to make decisions and that no decision was worse than the wrong decision in some cases. But it was a hard day.
Well, I honestly can't even imagine, but I want you to also say what now your third impact.
So I spent a lot of time thinking about our child welfare system, which continues to be a challenge today. So children whose parents either can't or won't take care of them and the state's responsibility to protect them and keep them safe. And one of the things that I did, there have been a lot of recommendations and we implemented many of them, but two things that I did, one was to extend to any child who aged out of our foster care system the ability to go to any college or university in Massachusetts free with a full scholarship, tuition, room, and board, so to give them access to opportunity and the same opportunity we'd want to provide to our own children. But more importantly, I also unilaterally at the bargaining table gave significant raises to social workers in order to bring them up to a more professional level of pay so that we could try to retain folks in what has to be to this day one of the most incredibly difficult jobs in public service and maybe in any public or private setting in the U.S. are the social workers who deal with families in crisis and have to make gut-wrenching decisions about whether or not to remove children from the setting they're in and then what to do with them. As our society has changed and a lot more women like me work, it's just really hard to find warm, nurturing family settings to place deeply troubled children into when you have to remove them from home.
And gosh, I agree with that so much. It's so good that you did that. Like, I think kids in foster homes, there's such a wide range of experience, and it's only the social workers who are kind of the determinants of when a foster home has gone over the line. And it's so important that you have good people there. But let me ask you about the college thing. What you kind of promising free college to kids who go through the foster care system, did that encourage colleges to say, hey, we've got to push back and now raise tuitions on middle-class children who then might not have been able to afford it?
So no, although I think a lot and would love to engage in a deep debate about the things that drive increases in college tuition. And like you, thinking about it even more deeply with a junior and two freshmen in high school. But here's the sad, shocking statistic. So in Massachusetts, we have actually one of the best high school going to college rates in the country. I think it's somewhere around 70% of students who graduate from high school who matriculate within a year into some post-secondary institution. Do you want to guess what that percentage was at the time I was making this decision for foster children who aged out, so never permanently adopted, never reunited with parents?
That's incredible. So
it was 4%.
So 4%. So
it's compared to almost every school that they were in, where 60 to 80% of their peers were going on to school. So I have no idea actually, because I did it sort of during my term and nobody's ever reported back to me. I saw one great story actually in my local newspaper of a student who benefited. But in the first year, it was going to cost all of $1 million. And that compared to the, billion-dollar endowments of Harvard and the budgets, even, tens of millions of dollar budgets of our state colleges and universities, was a drop in the bucket. So
yeah,
it turned out to be one of those things that you could do without a huge fiscal impact.
What do you think of the argument that Harvard essentially is like a hedge fund with a college attached to it?
So I believe Harvard provides a phenomenal education at many levels, but the degree to which their reliance on an investment arm is pretty widely written about in the Boston Press, and I think an important thing for our individuals to know. Frankly, I think either of us, if we have a child who's lucky enough to get into Harvard, we won't spend a lot of time criticizing them, and we'll feel blessed that they did it. They have that opportunity. I try to spend more of my public policy brain worrying about all the kids who aren't and shouldn't go to Harvard, and the affordability and the access that they need to a high-quality college education.
So I want to actually kind of reel ahead and get to what you're doing now, which is you've been nonstop involved in education. Well, first off, after you left the governorship, they kind of dropped you off where they drop all ex-Massachusetts governors, where you taught at the JFK school at Harvard.
But, yes, that is the assured landing place. But I have to say, I got my full-time teaching gig at Williams. Teaching smart college students is a small amount of what I do every day, but I hope it will be one of the biggest lasting impacts I have, because I have had some really bright, terrific kids who I think are going to change the world in much more emphatic ways than I ever did.
But like at Harvard, were you like office mates with Michael Dukakis and William Weld or anything like that?
No. And so again, those pesky children, I wasn't able to pick my children and my husband up and work for free full time at Harvard for 6 weeks. So I would come in once a week and they would put me up at a really nice hotel, and only a mother with three children under the age of 5 can appreciate staying in a wonderful hotel all by herself that she's not paying for.
So now though, you're still heavily
involved. Find a real job.
You're still heavily involved in education, obviously, with yep. not only a real job, but you could potentially have substantial impact on education still. Tell us about what you're working on right now.
So today I run a company, Middlebury Interactive Languages, that provides high quality language learning opportunities to students in really two verticals. First and best known is our digital curriculum that provides English language learning, which is a new line for us, as well as traditional world language learning for Spanish, French, German, Mandarin, and Latin to over 200,000 students across the United States. So,
how do you get those students? How do you get them as customers?
A variety of different ways, mostly through institutions. So schools or districts will realize either they can't find enough staff or they don't have a high-quality textbook or other learning materials, and so they will hire us to be a part of their curriculum solution. Sometimes we provide highly educated, certified teachers from that state to help in the instruction. They do that online, but for the growing part of our business, we are replacing the textbook and other supplemental materials, and so not weighting down backpacks. and giving them much more robust learning. So, you know, a lot of folks worry, how do you get speaking skills when you're doing an online curriculum? But if you go into any traditional classroom in the country, there are 20 kids in the class and one kid answers a question and then maybe a second kid answers a question. Online, every child has to speak and submit audio files. So we actually reach a much broader swath of students with speaking and listening skills, as well as a lot of authentic cultural materials. And then every summer, last summer, we had nearly 800 students who studied in a four-week brick-and-mortar immersion learning high school and middle school students. Here in Vermont, we had two large academies and then three international academies, one in Beijing, one in Spain, and one in Quebec, for kids who really want to leapfrog their peers and get a great cultural experience, but also a robust language acquisition experience for the summer.
So in your basic software that's in schools, often a way to judge, let's say, the difference between your software package and Rosetta Stone and Duolingo and traditional courses is how many hours is the is your program the equivalent of, like, let's say, a regular
program? I think it's 180 hours or 170 hours of instruction for high school. So you hit on, so you must have done some research or you're very lucky. I generally am
a little bit of both.
Me too. So we actually are built specifically for the classroom, unlike Rosetta and Duolingo, who are more built for the consumer audience. So we structure our classes to be, or our courses to be, exactly similar, both in the amount of material as well as the types of activities. So we have graded assignments, we have mandatory recordings that you would expect to see in an education setting. The biggest criticism we often get is we actually have too much material. So we put a lot of videos into our courses, and we allow students to go back and listen to them over a long period of time. The videos and the audio that we use is native speakers at native paces. A lot of students aren't used to that. They're used to somebody really slowing down their speech in a classroom, but then they go to a country and nobody talks like that.
Right.
So oftentimes students will need to develop, and we help them to develop strategies for how you can actually understand what people are saying to you at native paces by picking up the words you do know, negotiating meaning, taking visual cues. So it's a really robust pedagogy that's based on the best practices that were developed by Middlebury College's famed language school, which has been the international leader in language acquisition for over 100 years.
So it's almost like, I would argue you're kind of... framing point is that you offer an immersion experience as opposed to a shortcut experience.
And it's aimed at academic excellence. So if you want to figure out how to, you know, just say hello or find the bathroom in Italy, you can take somebody else's course. But if you want to be able to write and understand the culture of the many countries that speak a particular language, then our courses are much better designed. And if from a practical standpoint, you're a teacher who's using our tools to enrich your classroom, the fact that they're designed around an academic setting makes a huge difference. You know, you have to be able to have assignments that students complete so that you can figure out if they're learning the material. Those are sort of core principles in the courses we develop.
So I want to reel back just a little bit. 2003, you're considering the run for governor again. You had been governor for two or so years, a little over 2 years, and this super rich guy comes on and says he wants to be governor, and he's not going to do bake sales. He's going to spend $100 million of his own money.
What's... Even my Catholic family wasn't big enough to have bake sales right. that would compete with Mitt Romney's tens of millions. You are right.
So what was like you? It sounded like you really enjoyed the experience of being governor, and you had a lot of impact, and you dealt with a lot of very important issues. But of course, you were thinking there were many things yet to be done. What was that decision like not to run against Mitt Romney?
Gut wrenching. I can still. Feel like I had a physical, rock in my stomach. Back to your other comment about you wanted to figure out how I had twins and a toddler at home. My husband gave up his work life to allow me to serve in politics, and so I also was the sole breadwinner in our family. And have an awesome family and a wonderful husband. But politics doesn't make you rich, and I wasn't rich before I started. And so I had to face some really pragmatic realities. First, if I didn't win, I would probably have been through a very ugly, hard-fought battle that would make me less employable. And second, I wouldn't have a lot of time to find that job. And so at the end of the day, I made a really realistic, pragmatic decision that I was unlikely to win, and I was much more likely to lose and be in a position that would make it really hard for me to find meaningful work that would also feed my family and pay our mortgage. And so I stepped aside. I feel so fortunate today, being 12 years from that decision and realizing how many opportunities I've had to continue to make an impact on issues I care about. But I won't lie, it was bitterly disappointing. But I am confident I did the right thing. And most people have very hard decisions they make professionally and personally in their life. And frankly, it was the most difficult, probably professional decision I ever made. It was not anywhere close to the most difficult thing I ever faced in my life. So you have to keep perspective.
Well, and certainly you have to look at the, there's impact in politics and there's impact in business where you're actually creating things that people are using. And if it's a good idea, then many people use it. So you're CEO of Middlebury Interactive Languages. Now you have 200,000 people learning to speak in a globalized world through your software. That's an incredible thing, which may have eventually more impact than being governor.
Absolutely. And the time and resources to, make a difference. And because of that terrific job that I had way back when, I get to have wonderful volunteer and professional experiences that not many people do. I am indeed a very, very lucky person.
But can I ask you a favor before we close this podcast?
Sure.
Can you just run for president this year? Because I'm not really
My girls were joking because it seems like everybody can run and we are close to New Hampshire, but no, I can't.
Like, I don't like any, I mean, it's not like I hate them, they're all like the same. Like, I feel like you would be a little different. Like who, I don't know.
I love Jeb Bush and I understand the issue people have with his family, and the name, but I hope, that, students like the ones, that I, work with, understand that you should look at everybody on their merits. And I think Jeb Bush was a great president. I think his priorities are right. I like that he's not a demagogue on certain issues that, are not that important to me and I think are definitely to the Republican Party base. So I think there's actually quite a few really good candidates out there. Mine is Jeb Bush. But John Kasich would make, I think, a great president. There are lots of good candidates.
And let me ask you a naive political question, and this is on the Democratic side. Hillary Clinton has spent so many years or even decades putting a machine into place. How is Bernie Sanders even, approaching her in the polls? Like, what happened there?
for exactly the same reason that Donald Trump and Ben Carson, people are really alienated from our political system right now. And there's a really important message around that for both parties and people who care about politics like me. So I would say that, you know, anybody who's been engaged in politics needs to recognize and have a solution for how disengaged and angry much of the electorate is.
But he's
and
like
Bernie Sanders definitely channeled people's anger on the left.
Yeah, that's true. Who do you and Trump? You would say Trump and Ben Carson are channeling it on
the
right.
Yeah, probably even more Trump in a way. I mean, they oversimplify, but they certainly capture the mood and frustration. I think once folks start to actually think about the serious problems that we face and what they we need to do to solve them, things will look very different.
Well, Governor Jane Swift, ex-Governor Jane Swift, youngest governor ever, I think, and first female governor of Massachusetts, which is, you're a Republican in the most liberal state in the United States, and now you're the CEO of Middlebury Interactive Languages. I really appreciate you coming on the show. It's been an honor to have you on here and put up with my interrupting and answering my questions.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jane. I will talk to you again. Bye.
Bye-bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.